Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, actor Dennis Farina, directors Dennis Lee and Jim Loach, and a couple of film score premieres, plus some talk of some of the past weeks and weekends movie news.
Sounds good. I have a question for you, Jamie.
Okay.
Is Jim Loach related to Ken Loach by any chance?
It's his son.
His son. Wow. Okay, that's cool. That's very good to know.
So I mean, really, the last segment of tonight's show with Dennis Lee and Jim Loach, they're talking about their debut films, because Dennis Lee's debut film is Fireflies in the Garden,
right,
and Jim Loach's Oranges and Sunshine. Both have another thing in common: they both feature Emily Watson.
That's great. You can never have too much Emily Watson. That's all I gotta say. No, I love her. She's one of my favorite actresses. So I've ever since like Metroland. I don't know, was it Metroland or Breaking the Waves? I don't know, one of those. But yeah, she's incredible.
I know that Breaking the Waves was the movie that really like.
Well, that was
the
thing.
But
I think I watched Breaking the Waves after Metroland. I'm trying to think. Or no, Hillary and Jackie was the first thing that I saw that really just blew me away with her in it.
Yeah. So I've seen three movies this weekend.
Okay, let's hear them. Let's hear which ones you saw.
I'm sorry. I've seen four movies this weekend.
Okay, well, just out with it.
Amazingly productive of me. I saw a Serbian film.
Wow, better you than me. I just have no interest in watching that after everything I've heard about it. I just have no interest. I mean, I'd rather just go, you know, be shot up at a 7-Eleven or something.
It's competently done. I was expecting some kind of cheapo exploitation, but it's like wannabe artsy exploitation. So
I don't know what's worse.
I don't know either.
So what are your thoughts on it?
You're absolutely right. It's a little insincere when you gloss up the exploitation.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on it, though?
I don't have many.
Okay.
I just why you'd want to make a movie like that? You have the money and the resources. Why you choose to do that? I mean, it's just my own personal opinion. And plus,
right? No, I understand. Yeah,
I always kind of think it's disingenuous to kind of say to make a movie like that and say, but it's really a political statement or a statement about where we are today as a country and all this kind of stuff. I mean, they try to do the same thing with. I don't know. I don't know if I believe it or not.
Right. Well, isn't that like what the guy, the director, Zack Snyder, said about Sucker Punch was about feminism? It was, remember, and he got hammered for saying that.
Yeah, but that's almost safe to say because, I mean, that's a cast of females that feel very empowered. And
right.
They're the strong role models in it. A Serbian film, I mean, there's not a mention of politics in the movie. There's nothing like that. And I know that allegory needs to be subtle so it doesn't hit you over the head. But the fact of the matter is, the movie is meant to hit you over the head in every other way. I mean, that's what it does. But and then to turn around and say that it has a message, it just seems disingenuous to me.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you 100% there.
Then again, I mean, I'm working on The Shining show.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the horror films that led up to The Shining are clear indications of where we were as a country in turmoil during that period, more so than most. But I think that's more the mood of the time that embedded itself in the making of the film and what drove people to see that movie. I mean, those movies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was anything extroverted.
Right.
You know, Chainsaw never really mentioned Vietnam, I don't think.
None of the great allegorical films ever mention what their allegories about, or books, or music, or anything. They're just, you know, unfortunately, I don't know, we don't live in that time anymore where you can get away with that so much, but, yeah.
So, but the other big horror movie is is another one that I saw. I saw two other horror movies.
Okay.
I saw The Thing remake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a prequel. It's not. It is really a prequel, though. If you stay and watch the whole thing, you know.
Yeah. Well,
but you wouldn't know that, though. And I mean,
I would say the opposite. I would say they say it's a prequel.
Oh, but
it's really a remake.
But it's a prequel in terms of, oh, how can we say it's not? But I mean, I'm just going on the basis if you know the original. Well, not the original, but the remake of the original. And you know, it's, look, let's be honest, it's not. It is a remake. It's, hey, it's in the Antarctica, it's cold, we're isolated, we got a lot of blowtorches we can use. I mean, yeah, it's a remake, come on.
Yeah, and the beats are all the same, the progression of the story. And as I was watching it, I just kept thinking back on the Carpenter version, which is superior in every way.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, this movie had no personality of its own. So it... I wrote that it evaporated as you watched it. I mean,
it reminded me of another remake, actually. Toby Hooper's Invaders from Mars is the thing I kept thinking of, especially when you get to the last half hour of the film with the alien spaceship and everything.
Yeah.
Which I don't remember being so big in the original film. I mean, what happened?
I don't know. I guess the story has a certain fascination. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, this one was just dead in the water for me. And then I saw Paranormal Activity 3, which I'm sure you did, too.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I know. I did check that out. You know what?
Everybody
saw
it this weekend.
I saw that because I saw the other two, and I figured, Jesus Christ, I've invested this much time in it. I might as well see this one.
A big success. It's like the biggest opening since Harry Potter, I think.
Okay, that sounds about right, and both justifiably so. Maybe Harry Potter more, but no.
But,
Paranormal Activity 3, interesting.
If you think about it, I mean, the first one was made for tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was made for $3 million. This one was made for $5 million. So it's still sticking to its low budget roots.
Yeah.
Made for $5 million. They didn't spend a lot of money to market it.
No, really. They didn't. No.
And it's already made 10 times that on mm-hmm. on its first 3 days.
Yeah.
That's a successful formula.
Do you think how do you make another one after this, though?
I have no idea.
I don't know how I say it's, you know, you sort of really... I look at it, the film I compare it to is The Last Exorcism, because I either think you either, if you, that last 15 minutes is going to make or break it for you, I think.
Cause yeah.
That's quite a... Yeah, that's quite a ending for the whole thing. And you, God damn it, man. I mean, those psychiatric bills for those girls. I mean, oh, my God. Okay, never mind. But
yeah, I mean, but we said the same thing about the second and third one. How are they going to make another one?
Yeah, they will. They will definitely make another
one. They'll find a way.
Yeah, they'll definitely find a way. They'll just do it. Yeah, I mean, but it's just an interesting, the explanation is, and it's just very interesting. But I have to say something about these films. There are some genuine scares in all three of them. I mean, genuine, like, real scares in them.
Yeah. And scares that depend upon suggestion
mm-hmm.
rather than, you know, exploitation or being grotesque, you know. That's why, if this third one works, that's why I think it does work. Because
mm-hmm.
it's actually the most different of the three. It tries the most different things. But at the same time, it works because it sticks to the formula.
Yeah, it does. You're right.
So I thought it was effective. I thought it was kind of diminishing returns from the first and second. But at the same time, I appreciated
mm-hmm.
the different stuff that they tried with it. And I liked the girls, in it. I like the little girls in it, which sounds they're good performances, is what
right.
I mean. And it has some genuine scares in it, some very inventive camera stuff in it, the oscillating fan camera.
Yeah, that was good. That one scene with there's just one scene with the babysitter though in the kitchen that's just like so freaky. I mean,
yeah.
Oh my
yeah.
God.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
And you know, you keep thinking, how much is this going to turn out to be like Poltergeist, especially in that kitchen scene where you expect her to walk back in the kitchen and see the chair stacked on the table?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They kind of do something different with that.
But it owes a lot to Poltergeist, I was thinking. Oh,
sure.
The whole series owes so much to Poltergeist. It's really amazing how much it owes to that. And Poltergeist is one of those movies that still, it still scares me. I don't care. You know, that first one is a real scary movie.
Yeah.
And these films are no different in that regard. They have some moments. I thought this third one, I thought there were some really genuinely terrifying scenes.
Right. Well, yeah, and 100 years into movie making, 100 plus years into movie making, every movie is going to owe something to another movie.
Right, of course.
Essentially. But I think this movie did it largely right. The stuff that I don't like about it, I don't like the on-the-nose stuff with the coven at the end and all that kind of stuff. That felt really fakish to me.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I mean comparing it to The Last Exorcism and the last 5 minutes of that film.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you remember, everyone loved that film. A lot of people liked that film up until that moment.
Right.
And then they go ballistic on it. And I think that's going to be the case here with this film. I think the thing with the coven is going to piss off a lot of people who are fans of the series. I think they're going, oh, you know. Because I think it takes you out of the whole experience, personally.
Yeah. Yeah, it does, and at a time, at the climax of the movie, when it should be doing the opposite.
Yeah, and also, how does that, given the, I don't remember the stories 100%, but how does this get glossed over in these two sisters' lives? How does this, like, major event just sort of get...
I don't know, and it feels very odd that, I mean, those are their family videos, yeah, that they still carry around.
Yeah, I mean...
And this one, mom and dad, you know, got killed by the ghosts in the coven, and yeah. Which I'm not giving anything away because you know that the tragedy happened from the first
right,
two movies.
Right, but it just seems odd. You're right, odd. I mean, it's just like really. Hmm.
Yeah, I like the videographer sidekick character.
He was
in the
funny.
Movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought he was good, and I thought that Bloody Mary scene worked really well with him and the
mm-hmm.
little girl. Thought that was great. It still delivers. I mean, it delivers.
What I liked about that, though, here you have this guy who's, okay, of the two of them, obviously, in that scene, is the adult. And he's trying his best to be protective. And he is, you can tell, he is so, and as I think any of us would be, scared shitless.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't know. And it's a very effective scene. That whole
And you feel that. Yeah, you feel that fear.
Mm-hmm.
Fear. And have you noticed... A lot of their marketing, a lot of their promotion and teaser trailers and stuff and scenes aren't in the movie. So I think they actually shot a lot of stuff.
Yeah, well, the most famous is that you speak of the Bloody Mary scene
yeah.
with the two girls. I mean, I was looking for that, and I was like, wait a second, where is that?
They shot a lot of stuff that's not in the thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And I don't think it ever belonged in the thing. I think it was just shot for promotion of the movie.
Mm-hmm. I agree with
you. This is directed by the filmmakers of Catfish. I think it was a good way to capitalize on their success with Catfish, and I think it's largely a good movie. I mean, I would give, if I gave the first two a B+, I'd give this a B.
Mm-hmm. I would do that, and I think Catfish is a good movie. Is also another in its own way very frightening.
Yeah.
So they were the perfect people to do this film. I have no problem with it. It does what it's supposed to do.
And speaking of exorcism and the whole style of Paranormal Activity, did they play the trailer to that exorcism movie? I can't even remember the name.
Yeah,
of it.
I don't remember the title at all. But yes,
it's
they
a handheld, videotaped, documentary style, you know, exorcism
mm-hmm.
movie. coming out in January.
Of course. Everything's coming out in January. Even good films, it looks like, are coming out in January.
The Mark Wahlberg Contraband movie coming out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder, we watched a little bit. I didn't watch we didn't watch much of it, but the Anthony Hopkins movie, The Right, was on HBO last night. We just watched a little bit of it, and then we watched, because it was on demand, the new Kevin Spacey movie, Margin Call, which was very good.
Oh, you saw that?
Yes.
Good.
It's superb. I really thought it was, you talk about a scary movie, that in its own way is very scary, but we watched some of The Right, and I'm sure Hopkins' performance is over the top, and a lot of people said it was the only good thing about the movie, but I gotta be honest, I just don't care about exorcisms anymore enough.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just don't care.
Yeah. I can't say that I really care very much either, but is Paranormal Activity 3 scarier than Tower Heist? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see.
I don't know. it's interesting you bring up Tower Heist, because a couple of weeks ago there was a whole controversy with that, because that was going to be the first on this. What was it, they asking you to pay $40 or something?
No. $60. So this was the deal. The studios are so desperate to try this. They're so desperate to try to release a movie in theaters. 3 weeks later, offer it at home for an enhanced price, and then put it out on DVD like 2 months after that. And at every turn, they've tried this before. At every turn, the theater exhibitors always join together and protest and say, we're not going to play your movie if you do that, because you're belittling us and giving us a shorter window to make a profit. And that's absolutely what they're trying to do. Because
right.
when a movie opens in a theater, first weekend, I don't know the exact percentages, but it's near this. The first weekend, it's 80% to the studios, 20% to the theaters. And each subsequent weekend, the theaters get a larger gross.
Right.
A larger percentage of the profit from ticket sales. That's why concession stands are so expensive, because that's the only way theaters really stay in business. So if you limit the ability of people to only see this movie when they go out to your theater, if you limit that window, then it hurts the theaters.
Right.
And so that's why they're really taking a stand against it. And their plan was for Tower Heist to charge $60, $59.99, 3 weeks after Tower Heist came out in theaters, so you could watch it at home. I don't know how successful that would be. I don't know how many people would spend $60. Remember when VHS first started?
Yeah.
And when VHS would come out, if you were to buy those tapes?
Like $100.
Yes. That's similar.
Yeah, you know, you're right, it is similar. I'm just trying to think, all right, you know, we broke it down. You know, last night with Margin Call was $6.99 or on demand for four people. That's an awesome deal. Awesome deal.
Yeah.
But I would have to invite like 20 to 30 people for Tower Heist. I mean, no, we're just going to the movies to see. All right, we're just going to the early show or whatever.
I mean, right. You need the redecorating cost to build
a bigger living room and the whole thing. But $60 for I don't care what the movie is. I don't even care if it's all right. Maybe Jerry Lewis's Day the Clown died. Maybe Day the Clown died or whatever.
Yeah.
But otherwise, no. I'm sorry, $60. You've got to be kidding me. I mean,
it's ridiculous. But you know, apparently they thought that Eddie Murphy and the big cast in Tower Heist would bode well for it. I think the movie will do fine.
Well, I think it will do fine, but I mean, because Eddie Murphy's in it, I mean, okay. I like it.
Right.
You know, Eddie Murphy was very funny at one time, but I'm sorry.
So, yeah, that comes out in a couple of weeks, or I think.
Yeah, that comes out in November. So we're, I think, two weeks from now.
Yeah. And the other movie I saw was Bad Teacher. I finally got around to watching that.
I'm alone in that, but I was disappointed in it. I mean, that's just me.
I laughed enough, I guess. It was fine.
But
I mean,
let me ask you a question. Compared to the trailer, though, the trailer, which I think is a great trailer, it just didn't live up to that. That's just me.
Yeah. I mean, I guess how you could see that.
Yeah.
I don't have much to say about it.
Okay, well, that says something, too. But that, to me, that and Your Highness were, like, I thought, just based on the trailers, had a lot of potential, and both of them, to me, just were letdowns.
Yeah, I'll check out Horrible Bosses.
Now, that was good. That was funny.
I'll check that out.
Very funny.
Let's get to our first interview tonight, and then in between this interview and our closing interviews, I think we're going to bring on Dean. But we're also going to talk about big news involving Stephen King's The Stand.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, good stuff, good stuff. And who was just announced as the director of that. But first, Dennis Farina, great, great actor. Get Shorty, Saving Private Ryan, Crime Story, Midnight Run, on and on and on. He's done great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He has a new movie out that opens this coming Friday in limited release. It's called The Last Rites of Joe May. Had a really successful Tribeca Film Festival premiere last year, it is his best performance, and it's the role that gives him the most kind of breathing room to create a memorable feature character. He is the star of this movie. It's a great film about a small time con man just trying to get by in the last days of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Farina is very passionate about it. He came on to discuss the film, what drew him to it, and what continues to draw him to acting in film. And he gives us a sneak peek of his new project with Michael Mann, which is the HBO series Luck, where his cool. co-stars are Dustin Hoffman, Nick Nolte, and Joan Allen. Dear God. I mean,
when is that premiere? When does that?
January. Like you said, everything's in January.
Oh my God! But that's gonna be. Oh my God.
I know. TV series, man.
Oh man. Wow. Okay. Wow.
All right. Here's Mr. Farina.
Joe May, where you been?
County Hospital.
How long they keep you?
7 weeks.
Where?
It's $400.63.
That's it.
What do you want, Joe?
You see, Lenny, I think I still have something to offer.
How long have you been running short money, Joe?
My whole life. So what'd you do with all my stuff?
I threw it away. This is my home. 40 years. Times change.
I got a little proposition for you. You need a place to stay, and I could use a little help with the rent.
I just always thought that there was something out there for me.
Baby, I know you're in there.
Hey, look, you know what? I think you better go before I call the cops.
I am the cops, you idiot.
What the hell is this? As long as I'm around this joint, nobody's gonna hurt you. I got a couple of really good moves left in me. Like that people. Wow. You didn't even see it coming, am I right? I know people. People who take that crumb out, no questions asked.
What interests me first of all about this project is your connection to it. When the script came your way, what were the elements of the character of Joe that you really connected to?
Well, as soon as I read the script, I read about the first 10 pages or so, I knew I wanted to do it. I thought he was I thought you knew who Joe was the first 5 minutes that you meet him.
Mm-hmm.
That the character was pretty much explained in those 5 or 10 pages that I read. And I was always a little surprised at what was going to happen next. You know, when I found out that his apartment was taken away from him, and then I wondered what else could happen to him, and then his car was taken away from him. He didn't have as much money as he thought he had, and everybody thought he was dead. So it was an interesting journey for me to find out what mm-hmm. was going to happen to this guy. And I also thought he had kind of a nobility about him, although he was what he is what he is. You know, he's a street hustler, but I think he lived by a little bit of a code, and he wanted to keep up that image at all costs.
Yeah. Have you known people like Joe May in your own life?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
They're a bit of a dying breed, though, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's what's interesting about him. They don't. He was certainly a fish out of water, and I'm always attracted to those kinds of characters. I don't know why. I just like that idea of of those kinds of persons. I thought he had a. In a way, his sense of humor was that he was so serious about himself. Mm-hmm. And when people are like that, I think they're funny without meaning to be funny.
Well, what interested me to hear from your actor's perspective is, what do you think his dream was, and why don't you think, what was it in him that kept him from achieving it?
Well, I think his dream was what all con men are. You know, they always want to make that next score, and they always think they can do better, and they always think they're a little sharper than everyone else when they're really not. Mm-hmm. And that's what drives them. That's why they get up in the morning. You know, if they made $50 yesterday or $75 yesterday, they think they're going to make $100 today.
Yeah.
But his time has come and gone. People won't do that anymore. They can't. People are a little sharper than what they used to be. Joe hasn't realized that his time has come. And his final redemption is what he does at the end of the movie. I don't want to give anything away, but what he does at the end of the movie, he feels justifies everything that he's done up to that point.
I think that's what impressed me most about the movie, because it feels so truthful that he does have a redemption at the end, and that could have easily been played for sentimentality, I think. And the movie's not sentimental. It's honest about who Joe May is. Was that a difficult balance to get right, or was that just in the script? That feeling?
Well, it was a little bit of both. Joe Maggio, who wrote and directed the movie, told me in the beginning, he said, it's very easy for you to get sentimental about this, to get sentimental about the girl, and to get sentimental about the little girl, the daughter. He says, I don't ever want Joe to be sentimental. Mm. No matter what he is, he's Joe May. And he's got to keep that image up. That's why in a lot of the scenes, you know, there's one scene where Jamie Allman's character asks him to hug her. And I can't do that right now. You know, because he couldn't do that. He's still Joe May. And that was kind of, it was hard to do, because your first reaction is you know, you want to be warm and cuddly, but Joe Maggio didn't want him that way. He wanted him to be Joe May up until Joe May makes that final turn and gets his redemption at the end.
And I love that about it, because, I mean, the thinking, I guess, when you're making it or creating that character is, man, is the audience going to respond to Joe May? Are they going to like him? But I think we do, because we sense that he's authentic. You know, he's the real deal. Yeah.
And there's another thing about him. There's a certain nobility about him that he doesn't want to become romantically or sexually involved with Jamie's character because the little girl is there.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't want to cross those lines either.
This was originally set in New York.
Right.
And you suggested a switch to Chicago, which it was switched. What was it about Chicago that spoke to the truthfulness of this story? And what does it bring out in Chicago?
Well, several things. Number one, I hadn't worked in, you know, I live in Chicago. I was born and raised there, and I still live there. And I hadn't worked there for a while, so I was itching to work in Chicago. Mm-hmm. The other thing was that we got a pretty good tax break from the state of Illinois. And the other thing was that we always knew that the weather would be another character in the movie. And while it's cold in New York in the wintertime, there's no place that's colder than Chicago in December and, you know, January. Mm. So we wanted the weather to be it another character. You know, if this movie takes place in May or June, it's a different kind of movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there, I think we lose some intensity. And we got what we wished for. It was really cold and it rained and it snowed. And every time, it seemed every time we needed snow, it snowed. And when we needed rain and windy weather, it worked for us. It was as if it was planned.
You've given so many, you've done so many great movies and given so many great performances. But when you're doing it, like when you're playing a Joe May and the process of doing it, can you feel when it's working, or is there always an uncertainty?
Well, I think there's always an uncertainty because you always want it to be, you know, to be 100%, and I don't know if you always get that. But there are some scenes that you do, and you say, you know what, I felt pretty good about that. But I'm a really bad critic of myself. I can't do that. You know, I can't, I don't know what's good or bad. You know, I just...
Well, you're very, very good. So let me tell you. so, are you comfortable watching dailies or watching yourself? Or?
No, I'm not, and I never have been, and I probably never will be.
Mm. Well, thinking about the directors you've worked with, I mean, the name that obviously pops up more than any other is Michael Mann,
mm-hmm.
and he strikes me as a very meticulous, detail-oriented filmmaker. Is that what he is for the actor?
Oh, yeah, he is, but not to the point where he's closed-minded about things. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people make that mistake, not only about Michael, but about other people, you know, that he's meticulous. He's and with Michael, when you go to work for Michael, no one knows the material more than Michael. If he picks a subject to work on, he will research that to the nth degree. And you come in and he shares that all with you.
Mm.
If you have something to say, or you have an opinion, or you want to try something, he's very open to stuff like that. And you can do that. And you can make a case with him. I don't know an example, but if you go in and say, you know, I heard this, or I think this, or I think that, and you can make that case with him, and you can try it. He'll let you do that. He's not close-minded at all.
Mm-hmm. But you have to know your stuff, obviously.
You have to know your stuff, yeah, but I think that's with anybody. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I think any director, I mean, directors are supposed to know, you know, the subject more, than, I guess, than anybody. But with Michael, he's open to stuff like that.
Well, seeing the previews for Luck, which is your new project with him, an HBO series with Hoffman and Nolte, and that's quite a pedigreed project. What can you tell me about that one?
Well, I met with Michael and David Milch, and they asked me if I would be interested. I read the script. I liked the script right away. And then they told me, well, Dustin Hoffman is going to do the part. And I met him, and we got along right away. Nick and I don't have too much to do together, but, of course, we see each other at the readings and talk all the time. He's a wonderful guy and, you know, tells wonderful stories. He's just a lot of fun to be around. Nice guy, very nice guy.
Yeah,
but we also have you know, Kevin Dunn and Joan Allen and Jason Gedrick and Michael Gambon. You know, there's all these wonderful people that have come around.
Mm, I cannot wait for that. And that's early next year, I think.
In January, I think.
Wow. Well, you've worked with so many great people. I mean, looking back through your resume and from Saving Private Ryan and Get Shorty and so many great directors. Is there a lesson you've learned from any of your collaborators that has proven most valuable to you in your own work?
Well, Michael told me at one point, this is years ago when we were doing Crime Story, Michael told me there's going to come a point during this process where no one will know this character better than you. Mm-hmm. He said it's just going to happen. It happens to everybody. You know, you get up in the morning and you say, I really found what this character is and what he does. And he said, don't ever let anybody make you do something that you don't think the character would do. Mm-hmm. You know, so be prepared to fight for that. And I asked him, I said, well, what if it's you that asked me to do something that I wouldn't do? He says, I might be the exception.
Wow.
But he told me that, you know, and I always, that always kind of stuck with me, that at a certain point, you may know more about the character than anyone else.
Yeah, yeah. I just had one more question for you, and it's about working in independent film, because you've worked in both, you know, the bigger studio movies and independent film where the pace is a lot faster. Does that put different demands on you as an actor when you're working at that fast pace, and is it helpful in any way to you?
Well, I kind of like it because, you know, you have a set time. You have 3 weeks or a month to do this, and there's no... you know, the luxuries aren't there. So you have to know what you're doing. You have to know the script. You have to be prepared to move pretty quickly. And mm-hmm. I kind of like that. I like that pace. It's always wonderful to do a big studio movie because you get all the perks and everything with it. But I kind of like independent filmmaking. I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's what films were like to begin with.
Yeah.
You read all these stories about the early film companies, and they were always stealing shots here and moving and doing things that they weren't supposed to do because they didn't want to get caught. You know, it's like guerrilla filmmaking, and I think that's more true to what films were like originally when they first started making them.
Okay, that is actor Dennis Farina. His new movie is The Last Rites of Joe May. It's a rare starring role, and he's terrific in it. It's a great showcase for his talent. It opens up in limited release on Friday, so check it out. And then Luck, his new series with Dustin Hoffman, Michael Mann, Nick Nolte, Joan Allen, Michael Gambon, on and on and on, premieres January on HBO.
Sounds good, man. Sounds really good.
Yeah, good guy. Dino?
Yes?
Are you sleeping there, Dino? Did I awaken you?
No, I was actually working on an article here. But.
Oh, okay, good.
And listening to Dennis Farina.
Okay. Well, it's good that you can.
How's Christopher Lee doing?
I'm actually working on an article about the show coming up. We've got about 177 paintings of Christopher Lee hanging up. There's only two paintings that are not of him. One is of Vlad the Impaler, and the other one is of Max Schreck-esque Nosferatu. So
Christopher Lee's in good company.
Yeah. Yeah, in the gallery over here, it's all Christopher Lee all the time. It's really great.
All right, yeah. Enough of that.
There's the theme.
Good.
So we're getting ready to show it next Saturday, and it should be really something else. Can't wait to see everybody's face.
Big movie news the other night, like Friday night it came through. The Stand is being retrofitted for a big screen treatment. The people behind the Harry Potter movies are spearheading it. They're talking about making it a multi-film series, maybe three films. So it's a big, big project. It's going to do service to King's epic novel.
Right.
And the big announcement that came through Friday is that the announcement of the film's director, which is Ben Affleck.
Wow.
I have no problem with that choice. I think it's a great choice. So,
yeah, me too.
Mm-hmm.
It was exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, it would absolutely not be anywhere near the first choice that I'd come up with.
Right.
But I think that he is a great. I think he's proven himself to be a very, very good, borderline great film director.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a project of this scope can really like be the ultimate testing ground for him.
I agree.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, then there's no argument here.
No, absolutely not. I mean, he's very competent, and it'll be great to see him flexing some new muscles.
Right.
So Ben Affleck directing The Stand, and meanwhile, the Dark Tower series that Ron Howard and Benicio del Toro were trying to get off the ground is, I mean, it's dead, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and maybe that was a question of budgeting. I know that some others have really suffered. Other projects have suffered because of budget cuts. I mean, the Lone Ranger movie with Johnny Depp, Bruckheimer producing.
Right.
Even with that.
He couldn't get that off the ground. I mean.
Yeah. Even with that, they had to cut out certain scenes that would have cost more money
mm-hmm.
to slash the budget.
I don't know about that Lone Ranger thing.
You don't think?
It's just weird for me to think of Johnny Depp in the secondary role of Tonto. You know, it just seems weird to me.
Yeah.
I mean, because that is a secondary role. I mean, you know, Tonto in the original show is not much part of things, really.
Right.
Well, yeah, it's like if Johnny Depp were in Sherlock Holmes and he was playing Watson.
Yeah, it's strange.
It was just a weird dynamic. I just don't see how you pull that off with him in a secondary role. I mean, who is going to play the Lone Ranger? Unless Tonto is actually, it's a revisionist thing, and Tonto is the major character then.
Well, are they still talking about Armie Hammer as the Lone Ranger?
The stuff you put in the freezer to keep things fresh?
You know Armie Hammer. Guy who played the Winklevoss twins in Social Network.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's who they're talking about.
Yeah, that would be odd. I mean, there have been big stars that have come on board for supporting stuff. I mean, Nicholson's a good example. I mean, Nicholson's Oscar, his second Oscar, came courtesy of a supporting role.
Right.
At the peak of his powers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's had, and Johnny Depp strikes me as someone that doesn't have that vanity, that movie star vanity necessarily.
I don't think
he hasn't played many supporting roles previous to this. If he has, they've been something akin to cameos, like in Before Nightfall or something like that,
mm-hmm.
where he's only had like one scene or something like that. But
you know, he's never watched any of his movies.
That's kind of common, I think.
Who's the other? James Spader has never watched any of his movies.
Woody Allen doesn't like to watch any of his movies.
Yeah, but you know that Woody Allen has seen his movies many times, just in the process of putting them together.
Right.
That's true. Although I'm just going to show this thing,
and I'll give you the footage, and you can do what you want with it.
I'm not going to watch it again. He does that. I mean, you know, that's how Annie Hall was put together. You know, he had three or four hours of footage. He even
talks about going in and making sure that the color correction and the sound mix is right and
mm-hmm.
all that kind of stuff before he lets it go.
Yeah, okay. But he does give a lot of the footage over and let the editor do
sure.
their magic, you know. So,
as he does with the actors, you know.
Yeah. It's not quite like, you know, Scorsese looking over Thelma Schoonmaker's shoulder while every cut's being made, you know.
Right.
There's a little bit of an old school kind of thing going on with Woody Allen and his editors. So,
is TV the right place for Stephen King?
Yeah,
I think that's been shown for. I mean, wait now, like the The Stand. I mean, is that going to be a television thing? It's going to be
a movie. It's going to be a movie, but I think television is more his thing than most of the time because of It and The Stand. Those miniseries, and I just think for such his books are so involved in everything, the longer ones at least they are more tailor made for because you're just going to cut out so much stuff otherwise that I just don't see how you do the work justice.
And it keeps Mick Garris employed.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean that's the guy. Yeah, in these troubled times, that's all I care about. Make sure Mick Garris and his family have food on the table.
Stephen King is to Mick Garris what Adam Sandler is to Rob Schneider.
Or Adam Sandler is to anybody in his movie.
Right. I don't The Stand miniseries was fine. I don't like the It miniseries. And I'd love to see that made into a feature film, which they've been talking
about. I read in the film comment just recently, you know, they have a little thing of like what's being remade every month in film comment, and they mentioned that there is a remake of It coming up.
It has been on the books
yeah.
for years, and there's been a director attached, and yeah, I think it's another one of those that are wallowing, you know.
Mm.
It's a tough project anyway. It's pretty grandiose. And then, you know, there have been some decent, and Bag of Bones is coming on AMC, I think, from Stephen King.
Oh, okay.
Pierce Brosnan's behind that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he's had some luck on television. I was having a conversation about part of the fifth episode of the Kubrick series, the Shining episode that we're in editing on now, Tony Magistrale is a part of that series, and he is a professor, he's an author, and the foremost Stephen King authority.
Mm-hmm.
So he's written a couple of books on Stephen King, Stephen King, America's Storyteller, and Hollywood Stephen King, and he knows King pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood Stephen King is really interesting because they go through pretty much most all of the adaptations, good, bad, or indifferent, of his novels. And he's very open and honest about them. So I was talking to friends last night, and we were going over, I think they're just as pretty much almost just as many good movies as bad movies from Stephen King.
I think that's true, yeah.
But when we think Stephen King movies, when we think Stephen King movies, why do we automatically think there's always bad ones, that they have no luck making good ones?
Well, I don't think that most of them are very good. I think that you can name maybe five of them that are good, and the rest of them are not.
See, I think you can name like 10 that are good. I think you can name 10 that are,
well,
or
let's
even
think.
Less that
let's
are
let's
bad.
Start. Let's go. I mean, Carrie.
Yes.
Shining.
Yes.
Shawshank
Redemption. Shawshank
Half
Redemption.
Pool, the Shawshank Redemption is the major turning point. I think actually, that's when it. Stand By Me.
Misery.
Misery's good.
The Dead Zone.
Dolores Claiborne. Yeah.
I love Dolores
Claiborne. Yeah, now we're getting shaky.
See, I think Dolores Claiborne's one of the best adaptations.
Yeah.
Now, what do we think about something like The Dark Half, though? I mean, that was, so-so. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, then we get into Thinner and Pet Sematary.
Cemetery was all right. Pet Sematary.
And now you're getting into the bad ones. Like, I think that they're equal numbers of very good Stephen King movies and bad ones.
I mean,
one of
you
the
know,
worst, maybe the one he directed. I mean,
yeah, Maximum Overdrive and I mean, like there's Silver Bullet and
Sleepwalkers.
How many are there?
Sleepwalkers
yeah.
is the one that comes to mind, yeah.
Firestarter.
Cujo. I rewatched Cujo just a couple of months ago.
Cujo's pretty good.
Cujo's a good one. Christine.
Yeah.
Not so great. For me, at least.
Yeah, but
Did
you wouldn't say it's,
car,
you would, you wouldn't say it's
you
a bad movie.
Nah, it's like a 2.5-star movie. You know?
Right.
Yeah,
Salem's
but,
Lot is another TV miniseries.
Mm-hmm. That was good.
Actually, you know what? I mean, his first three books were Carrie, Salem's Lot, and The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time The Shining came to movies, his first two books had already come out and had already been adapted into
mm-hmm.
films. I mean, so he was met for like extraordinary success right,
right
off the bat. But The Shining was his first bestseller was The Shining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
almost my favorite King movie is Carrie, the first one out of the
right.
Oh,
let's not
forget
The Dead Zone. The Dead Zone was great. I mean,
there's about five really great ones, and then there's some that are okay. And then the rest of them are not.
Right. Okay, and so tell me an author that five great movies were made of their work.
Well, I mean, Charles Dickens, I guess,
Charles Dickens?
Right now.
We're going that far back?
What do you want me to say?
Saying that the common consensus is that there is no luck with Stephen King movies, that most of them are awful, and I don't think that that's the case. I think that the batting average is far better with Stephen King than most.
Let's be very honest. It was Elmore Leonard until Get Shorty that he hated the adaptations of his work. I mean, let's say there's Cat Chaser, there's 52 Pickup, there's Stick. I think I like 52 Pickup is good, actually, but like Stick with Burt Reynolds is bloody awful. I mean, you have to go really far back with Elmore Leonard to something like Hombre or The Moonshine War that are good
Stick.
Things.
I think of The Deodorant every time I hear the title of that movie.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure you do.
Five minutes. So, but I think that's a worthy topic for another series. Because I'm thinking about other series, and maybe examining Stephen King movies, good, bad, or indifferent, is another good series to have.
Right.
And then we're going to do our series of the first quarter about musicals, because we've never done that. So
oh,
there's some exciting stuff coming the first quarter of next year. If you like musicals and Stephen King, there's
Carrie the musical.
I like that you're casting your net wide there.
Yes, if I can reach that one person that feels neglected because they love both Stephen King and musicals,
then you've
won. I would have succeeded. Yeah. If you can just reach one person.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What else is on the? By the way, I just watched a movie I wanted to talk to you about for a little bit. I watched Red State by Kevin Smith.
Okay.
I have to say, it started off pretty clunky. It had a pretty bad opening scene, I thought, in a classroom. But where the dialogue was too dialogue-y, like a lot of Kevin Smith's writing is. But once it got into the compound of the religious compound that's being run by Michael Parks, who I thought gave a really incredible over-the-top performance, once it got into the compound, I found it pretty enjoyable. I don't know
if enjoyable is the word I'd use. Once the Jews get into the concentration camps, I love Schindler's List. Yeah, I mean,
It was a horror movie. It was nothing more than a horror movie, really.
I didn't even think it was a horror movie. I think, though, my problem with the film is he shoots himself in the foot halfway through the movie.
I didn't see that scene.
I didn't see him shoot himself in the foot.
No, I mean Kevin Smith shoots himself in the foot. His whole argument is that this is about Fred Phelps. This is about the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah.
And then John Goodman makes this offhanded comment on the phone to one of his superiors. Oh, this guy's far worse than Fred Phelps in the Westboro Baptist Church. I was like, dude, that's terrible.
Yeah,
he should not.
Right.
That's a huge, huge. I know a lot of people wouldn't think that, but that's a huge mistake. If your movie is basically an indictment, you can't name him in the film, but to bring him up, I think you do yourself a great disservice to your movie. I really think that should have been cut out. I think it really neuters himself.
I didn't have any problem with that because. What that was line was saying is, Fred Phelps, all Fred Phelps needs to be as horrifying as these people in this movie are guns. That's it. If they have a stockpile of stockpiling
right,
guns when
right.
they hate their place, you know.
But
then,
my thing is this, your movie, you are the director, the writer-director, and your movie is basically made as a reaction against a very real person. And you mention that person in the film. It's sort of, it's very strange, but I just think he basically emasculates the film in one sense. He neuters it. It's just like, okay, wow, you just really, and for most people that wouldn't be a problem, but it's just like, if that's the thesis of your film, really, let's be honest, this is about Fred Phelps. This is who Michael Parks is playing, a very Fred Phelps inspired character. And you sort of, I think, hurt yourself when you do that. You sort of take a lot of the venom out of your film.
Well, I mean, there were other parts of the film that I thought were, once it gets into its wrap-up, which I won't go into, but it has a wrap-up that I think is a little silly as well. But I really looked at it as just another kind of horror film. And actually, you know, one thing about it was that I thought, you know, obviously I thought this from just seeing the preview, was that finally, and now at what I guess is Kevin Smith is saying is the end of his filmmaking career, he finally gets the gumption up to actually make a film with actual movement and editing and
yeah.
everything in it.
He actually has shown more directing prowess in this movie than any other he's done, because he has whole sequences that depend upon action and not dialogue.
Right. And
yeah.
That's the one thing that I was probably most impressed by.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, you know, not one of my favorite movies of the year by any means, by
no,
any stretch of
all.
The imagination.
No.
But an interesting film, and I did like Michael Parks in it quite a bit.
No, Michael
yeah.
Parks is good. Melissa Leo, it's basically like, hey, there's the long-lost sister of my character in The Fighter. But I have to say, I mean, I think Kevin Smith, what I like about Kevin Smith and what I've always liked about him is that's how people talk. And I always appreciated that's what his dialogue. He was always more dialogue-centric, you know, talky, basically.
That's why I thought that he should have always just written plays.
Me too.
I don't know about that. I think he's outside of Jersey Girl, I would say I liked everything he's made. Even Jersey Girl, there are parts of I like. But I just think, you know, that's how people talk, and I appreciated him for getting that right.
I don't think
yeah.
that he gets it right. I think I think a lot of it's really phony.
I disagree with that.
Phony and stylized, you know.
You could say the same.
No.
You say the same thing about Mamet.
Stylized, I wouldn't even go. Stylized and Kevin Smith just don't go in the same. The same country even. Stylized, no. But I just appreciate it because that's how people talk. That's how people. And it was just he captured something in Clerks and in Mallrats. I thought that's how people really. Talk, and I really appreciated that. And, of course, in the later films, like Dog... I mean, the problem is once you get to Dogma and Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, and especially Clerks 2, you are making very expensive inside jokes that only your fan base is going to get. Anyone walking in, it's like walking in the chat like to the fifth Harry Potter movie. No one's going to get this if they haven't watched the other films or know. That's the thing with Kevin Smith. He's made a very world.
Kevin Smith's dialogue is, I mean, it is theatrical. I think if if people actually wrote the way people talk, the majority of people anyway, it would be exceptionally boring dialogue. because,
I don't know about that.
80% of the time, we don't say anything of much consequence, of much, you know.
I agree with that, too.
To agree with that. I don't agree with that much anymore, but
I mean, the show is proof of that. We talked for 2 hours. How much
of
consequence?
Well, yeah, I mean, if we're using this show as the yardstick, yeah, you're absolutely right.
This stuff is always about, like, people saying the perfect thing at the perfect moment.
But there's nothing wrong with that, though, because...
Wait, Dean, what perfect thing at the perfect moment? Wait a second. That whole opening sequence
in Red State, for instance, with that teacher talking to her class about, you know, giving that classroom speech and everything. It was just so phony. When his dialogue comes through, I can see it written on the page. And there's just something
phony
about it.
Well, that particular scene is on the nose.
Is that an homage to John Singleton's Boys in the Hood? The opening of that?
Well, I mean, that's
an homage. I'm being facetious, you son of a bitch. I know what you're talking about. But I didn't think that red state is like the wrong thing I would use because, you know, that the whole.
I felt it ever since Clerks. That big long 10-minute sequence of him talking with his girlfriend about blowjobs and everything like that in Clerks. It just seems so.
But Dean,
what was
your favorite movie at the New York Film Festival? Tell me one more time.
Well, it was a movie called Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. From Turkey.
Is Kevin Smith really your filmmaker?
Yeah, I mean, let's be very honest.
Is he really the guy that's going to reach you?
It's like having Armand White review a Harry Potter movie. I mean,
he's not the guy that reaches me either. But I can say to people that, you know, he's not necessarily my bag. But
right, exactly.
I understand if he speaks to certain people.
He's definitely not my bag, for sure. But I will say this, you know, I mean, like, there's occasionally, you know, there's moments in Clerks, and there's moments in all those movies that I do like his stuff, you know. And I was actually kind of surprised by Zach and Mary Make a Porno. I thought that had some nice moments in it,
too.
Oh,
yeah, a lot of good moments. That was his chance to go into Judd Apatow territory. I mean, I've always said that Judd Apatow is a mainstream version of Kevin Smith. That's who he is. That's exactly who he is, because if you really break it down, they're sort of the same kind of filmmaker.
Well, Judd Apatow is a much better writer.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I'll give you that. But is Judd Apatow your bag, too, though? That's what I want to know.
Yes, he is.
Okay.
Yes, he is. I mean,
Just because his name sounds foreign? No, I'm kidding.
I've been a big Judd Apatow fan since Freaks and Geeks, which is, again, another example of, like, really great, you know. I think that's really, like, how people talk, that show, you know.
Oh, no, I think Judd is definitely that, but I also think Kevin Smith is that, too.
I don't know. Hey, let's take a little break.
Thank God. Thank you, Jamie.
Before we get on to another topic. Hey, here's the film score premiere, a little 2-minute clip of the film score for Puss in Boots. That'll cheer us all up.
Yeah, a double feature of this and The Skin I Live In. Yeah, fuck yeah.
Happy place. Happy place, guys. All right, Puss in Boots. Here it is. Henry Jackman score for Puss in Boots. Henry Jackman, the score is from Puss in Boots, the character from Shrek, Puss in Boots, Antonio Banderas. That soundtrack is available soon online. You can find it on Amazon, purchase it. Okay, we have a couple of listener emails that came in the past week. All of them from, like, overseas. I start to doubt that we have U.S. listeners. Email from England. I'm in England, he says.
Thank you. Geography 101. Thank you.
And I've been listening since about 2 years ago when I stumbled across your show when looking for De Palma interviews online. I listen to all the other older shows, and I downloaded the new shows every week. It's the only podcast I listen to, and it gets better and better, so keep up the great work. Some of my favorite movies are De Palma and Polanski thrillers, and it's great to listen to people who appreciate these as much as I do. Thank you for that email. Another one from Italy. Just a short note to say congratulations on the Kubrick series. As a longtime Kubrick aficionado, I've listened to part one, and though I have read several books on the subject, I found it riveting with great insights. And then he went on to tell me a story about how he was reading a Kubrick biography on an airplane from Australia, and the person he was sitting next to started a conversation with him and just so happened to have been one of the men that played the apes at the 2001 Donna Mann sequence.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
How's that for coincidence?
That's quite a coincidence.
Yeah. Let's. I also want to read some of these. So Armand White, our favorite film critic, he didn't leave the New York Press. The New York Press folded. And so everybody was like, where's Armand White going to go? And then I saw that he was still on the roster for the New York Film Critics Association. So he had to work somewhere, and that place is City Arts. It's a journal, New York Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And he released some capsule reviews that I'm loading right now, and some of these are very entertaining. So I'm just going to wait for these to load. So what's up, guys?
So when you mean capsule reviews, these are actually just really shortened. He's able to do that. He can actually not be so long-winded or have someone to make him not so long-winded.
He does both.
Okay.
Because he has posted longer versions of some of these reviews. 50-50, the buddy comedy genre faces cancer. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is helped through the crisis by Seth Rogen. Decent emotions get cheated of depth by Blythe non-spiritual approach. That's his take on 50-50. He loved Columbiana.
Mm-hmm.
He hated the debt. Drive. Fake toughness, fake sentimentality, fake style infected by Michael Mann. Brooding existential stuntman and petty criminal Ryan Gosling is so laconic and cool, he's inadvertently comic. The second-rate actor occasionally drops his Steve McQueen impersonation and lets slip Mickey Rourke's old smile.
God, Armand White, second-rate intellectual.
I have to say, I agree. I don't think we've talked about Drive since I've seen it, but boy, what an overrated movie that is.
I know. I mean, but you're in that camp. There are two camps. There's one camp that loves it and digs it, and there's another camp that says that movie's totally overrated and awful. It's, you know, I mean, it's such a divisive movie.
But I don't understand what people love about it.
Remedial pretentiousness that people either, you know, I can't believe he gets so much attention for basically just remedial pretentiousness.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm serious. That's what it is. I mean, I really don't think. I mean, and that goes for a lot of film critics these days. It's just like remedial pretentiousness. I mean, sorry.
Well, I mean, what does that mean exactly?
Retarded pretentiousness. That's what it means. It's just something very phony. It's dim-witted. You think you're being clever, but it really just sounds stupid. And Armand White.
Hold on a minute. A couple of weeks ago, you used the word pretentious in a positive form. You used the word pretentious in a positive form in
I must have been sober.
We're talking about Tree of Life.
Tree of Life. Melancholia. Hold on a minute. You said that that and Melancholia were the two most pretentious movies of the year, and you said that in a good way. You meant it in a good way.
What I meant, I was talking about it because I do think they're both very pretentious, but I do like them, but I do think they're both incredibly pretentious films. I mean, everyone, even the people who really love Tree of Life, are aware it's incredibly pretentious, and I don't mean it.
I don't mean it in a good or bad way.
That's how I would describe the film.
When you use the word pretentious, how are we supposed to know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't give a fuck how you think I mean it. That's up to you. That's your fucking perception, Dean. I don't give a fuck what you think.
But what differentiates what makes bad pretension? The phony?
I think the phoniness.
Yeah.
And that's what I think of Armand White. I just think he's a phony. I mean, I'm sorry.
I get it.
Big phony. I'm sorry. And I can't believe we've given him so much airtime on this show.
Well, here's a little bit.
I mean, really, it's insulting almost.
Well, I'm sorry I'm insulting you, but here's a little more. Moneyball, this is the quote I wanted to use, because I absolutely don't know how anyone could think this way about this movie.
Okay.
This may be the least enjoyable baseball movie ever made.
Oh, God.
Any idea how you can think that about Moneyball?
I do admit that I don't agree with anything that he, a lot of things he has to say. Most of the time I don't agree with him. I think that he's too hard on a lot of movies, and I'm not quite sure what he's expecting from some of the films he looks at. And sometimes, more often than not, I think he's just doing a form of performance art where he's there trying to push people's buttons, and he wants to sit back and see if he gets any kind of hate mail or whatever, you know.
He must be doing a good job. I mean, but let me ask you this: Do you think he's a failed screenwriter?
I don't think he's ever tried.
Question. I don't.
Is he someone who tried to make it in business and is a failed screenwriter? Because that would explain a lot.
Well, you know, I have a couple of people at the New York Film Festival that I've talked to, and they seem to think that, you know, a lot of film critics are failed screenwriters. I don't disagree. I think there's a certain number of them that are.
There is a school of thought that says, don't critique until you know of what you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Until you walk in those shoes. So I don't necessarily think that, having tried a career, I see what you're saying, that it would make him bitter towards people that are actually successful
sense.
At it.
And I wouldn't have a problem. It would make perfect sense. I mean, because he is bitter. I mean,
yeah, but
bitter.
I mean, Rex Reed is bitter too, and he had a stint in the movies that wasn't very successful. Roger Ebert is one of the most kind-hearted critics, and he had a stint as a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't look for people, for critics to agree with me.
Of course.
And that's the basis of hate mail. A lot of hate mail to these critics is just on the basis of that.
Yeah.
How dare you don't agree with me?
Well, I never understood that. It's fine. I mean, it's fine to have a difference of opinion, but it's just his are so mean-spirited.
Not justified. That's what his are.
Yeah.
I mean, when I read a criticism I disagreed with Pauline Kael, she could justify it.
Right.
And I could understand her point of view. And maybe that's the origin of his negativity and his feeling of superiority, Armand White, because he's a Paulette. I mean,
he's
one of the last remaining Paulettes that just go down with the ship.
Right.
With her, that refused to see any kind of faults with her approach to younger critics, or, you know, with maybe her mode of thinking on things.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I mean,
yeah,
although,
I think you're absolutely right. I think that nails it right on the head.
He's not as good as she is. that's the only problem. He either is not as good a writer as she was, or he doesn't have enough space. Like, you know, she would have, you know, tons of space to, like, to write about any movie she wanted to write about. So she just finished, you know, she would finish writing when she didn't have anything else to say. So I get the impression that he's a little bit more limited in space. Well, obviously he is, because New York Press, at least, was not that.
Well, he didn't have the breathing room that they gave Pauline Kael. Pauline Kael could write on forever. I mean, no one has that breathing room.
Yeah, exactly. So that could possibly be the reason why it doesn't feel like his ideas are fully explored. And that might be also another reason why he just seems to cut to the chase and just kind of pisses people off in the process.
But you don't understand his point of view. And with other film critics, I do. I mean, I understand why they feel what they feel.
Yeah.
Whether I agree with them or not. And Pauline Kael was, I mean, she had a way, reading her was fun because her sentences really popped. And there was no doubt what she felt about a movie and why she felt that way about it.
Well, made her great, and even someone I didn't always agree with, like her, or even Stanley Kaufman of the New Republic, or a really great critic, regardless of what the medium is, brings in other things. And that's what made her great. She brought in a lot of things. Armand White's big thing is, oh, I'm going to contrast this to another film.
Right.
And, you know, look, he just comes across as very bitter, but almost like to be the contrarian, nothing else.
Right.
It's almost like he's like, okay, I'm going to do this because I'm just going to take this point of view just because I know it will piss people off.
Yeah.
Do you know the big controversies that surrounded Pauline Kael and her critical career? Like the reviews that caused the most stir.
Which ones would those be? Which films?
One of them was Last Tango in Paris,
mm-hmm.
just because she thought it was the most extraordinary movie she'd seen.
Oh, yeah,
that was
big,
reviewing.
Yeah, I mean.
And when she loved something, she just glowed with it. I mean, it was like a passion that she had to write out and sing to the heavens about.
Right.
And other critics, you know, quote-unquote responsible critics, thought badly of that urge. But the one that gave her the most trouble was Shoa, her review of the 9-hour documentary on the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
She panned it. And the level of hate mail against her, say, how dare you, this is a sacred blah, blah, blah. And people were very, very offended by her negative review. But her point was, just because the topic is sacred doesn't make the filmmaking sacred. She
True.
Said,
mm-hmm.
And she was reviewing it as a film. But the problem area came in that people could not separate the filmmaking from the subject matter.
Right.
Either.
Well, interestingly about Shoa, when I was reviewing movies like a long time ago in college, and I read the Shoa review not too long ago, and was really surprised at the kind of intersection that we had, Kale and I, over the quality of that movie. I think that movie is overrated because it does. It does exactly what she says it does. The subject matter is so is so revered in it that the film ends up being boring because we have to sit through. Lanzmann doesn't want to cut out anything, so Lanzmann asks the French person a question in Polish or ask the Polish person a question in French, and then we hear the translator translate the question. Then we get the answer without any subtitles,
yeah.
And then we get the translator translating it, and we watch all of that. Now,
it's almost like morose porn.
Mm-hmm.
It goes too far.
It's another thing with the Holocaust. It's just, you're right, it's because the material is obviously sacred ground. I mean, it's something I have. It's a whole industry in this country, unfortunately. But I've always had a lot of problems with that. My God, can you imagine if you can imagine
this country
Brett Ratner made Schindler's List? I mean,
yeah. But you remember Keith got death threats for his negative review of The Dark Knight.
Yeah, but
I was thinking,
ridiculous. I mean,
I know.
It's just ridiculous. That's what I mean. It's not, look, you can, look, they're always going to be, and he was right. I understood, and he brought up some very good points that I could see from his perspective why that was not a good film. I could totally see that. Whereas from Armand White, you just see, oh, I just want to do this to piss people off, you know, I mean.
Right.
So I can totally, his review is justified from his point of view. I mean, he makes a very clear case why he does not like the film.
But there's just no, I think it's a reflection of the times that a lot of people in large part aren't thinkers. They're just adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
They're not open to anyone else's judgments.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, think like me. I blame it all on Christianity.
A lot of people look at movies, what movies.
Please
they
don't
like.
Write me angry hate letters, guys. I was kidding.
A lot of people look at the movies that they like the same way they look at the music that they like. They're not just movies and music. They're emblems of size.
Who they are.
Of their own personality and their
own
value.
It's just a whole narcissism.
Like,
I mean.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, they're almost—it's almost like, you know, people who love a certain sports team or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
they're gonna.
Thing, yeah. I mean,
it's the same thing, you know.
My,
but
my thing is this. Okay, let's say we all, you know, we come in with three different opinions of whatever movie, and let me. At the end of the day, is it really make that much difference whether you agree or disagree or you have the same feeling about a movie? Is it really gonna? I just say it's not big. It's a fucking movie. Give me a fucking break, or it's a book, or it's an album, or it's your sports team. Is that really, at the end of the day, is that what really matters? No.
Does
I don't
it really
think
matter
so.
To you if I don't like Stephen King, and but you happen to, or whatever, the Stephen King movies?
Well, the answer to that, Dean, is yes. For
but,
me,
no,
yes.
Dean, here's my response. Here's my response. I would be really disturbed if you had the same opinion as me. That would make me even angrier. Okay.
It's a little more boring, you know.
Yeah,
and,
I mean,
you know, the whole world is filled with lots of opinions. So, you know, I'm
yeah, there's going to be 15 billion of us in like 20, like in 40
yeah.
years or something. So you better get used to it.
And
yeah.
I personally like the movies. I think I've said this on the show before. I think the movies that are divisive are the most interesting ones.
Well, those ones that will last a lot longer. I mean,
yeah, I think they're the most interesting ones.
Speaking of divisive movies, I don't have a word place to go with this, but so we're 12 minutes in to editing The Shining show. So if I apply myself really hard this upcoming week, we'll premiere it next Sunday night.
Okay.
But I will say that the Hell Day, which is usually the Saturday before we premiere the Kubrick series, it will not be a Hell Day for me because that'll be my birthday, and I'll be staying away from it. That
there you go.
So
good plan.
I have to finish it by Friday, and if that happens, we'll be up and running on Sunday. I sent another interview request to Nicholson, and I gave him everything. I said, "Here's my home number. Here's my work number. Here's, you know, reach me anytime if you want to discuss." And so who knows. I will say, if Nickel and I gave him my, because I don't have a cell phone number, I gave my friend, my best friend, the his cell phone number, and I said, "Hey, dude, I gave him your cell phone number, so just in case he tries to reach me." And he's like, "What the hell am I supposed to do if Jack Nicholson calls my cell phone number?" Could you imagine that call out of the blue?
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, I wouldn't know what the hell to say to him. Just say Jamie's
well,
not here. I'll give
to be
you your
fair,
message.
It'll probably be his assistant calling or something. So
I don't know. I've heard things about Nicholson. I've heard that he stays up all hours of the night, and what he does is he talks on the phone. He calls everybody. Brando used to do the same thing. And then Nicholson sleeps until noon, and then he gets up and plays some golf or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Hangs out with friends, and then but all hours of the night he'll call people and talk on the phone, and I would hear like Brando doing that too, and he'd call up people like Harry Dean Stanton or Sean Penn or Johnny Depp or something. He's like Johnny, it's Brand Flakes, and then you know start talking about wild crazy
stuff.
Can you
buy me a Slurpee from 7-Eleven?
Brando would start quoting Shakespeare. He loved quoting Shakespeare. He could remember Shakespeare. He didn't have cue cards or anything with Shakespeare on it. Amazing.
That's funny.
Yeah. So who knows? Wouldn't that be something? Get a call from Jack Nicholson.
That would be, yeah, wow.
In the middle of the night.
Yeah. The only fear I have is I rarely know what the hell Jack Nicholson is saying. Have you noticed that? Have you listened to commentary or interviews?
That's a very good point.
I mean, he will go off on some tangent, and I don't know what he's talking about.
Well, I mean, he was very clear in the Corman documentary I just watched.
That's because
so,
that's
yeah.
edited. But if he,
yeah.
without the
you
benefit
have,
of
I
editing.
You can use, you have tools that you can use.
Yeah. So if I talk to him, obviously I'll be editing what he says for the Kubrick show, and I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, I'm not under any illusions, but... But it's getting to that point. It's that uncut phone interview where if he brings up something I don't understand, me trying to save face and play off like, oh, yeah, I understand it perfectly. so as to not let him think that I'm a moron. That thought makes me uncomfortable.
Mm.
Yeah. So, Walking Dead tonight, Boardwalk Empire tonight, Dexter, all the Sunday
favorites.
Big
night. Huge night.
It's a good episode of Walking Dead tonight. I didn't catch Boardwalk last week.
Oh, that was good.
I did watch it. I had it on mute. I saw that Gretchen Mol was naked, so I watched a little of that. But other than that, it's the only scene I watched. Is that bad? Is that wrong?
You're honest.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to close off the show tonight with two interviews back-to-back. I'll play them, and then the show will be over once the last interview ends.
Hey, are we having a show Wednesday, or?
No.
Okay. All right.
Taking a break.
I understand.
We're not taking
a
break. We're
still
working.
Little editing break.
Yeah. Okay. Two debut films. One from a filmmaker named Dennis Lee. His movie is Fireflies in the Garden. It stars Julia Roberts, Ryan Reynolds, Willem Dafoe, Emily Watson. He assembled quite a cast for his first movie.
That is. That's an awesome cast.
It's about a family tragedy. How the death of a mother kind of impacts the relationship between the troubled son and the abusive father, and what it lays wake to. And then the second interview is with Jim Loach, son of Ken Loach. Aranata Diaz did this interview for us. The movie is Oranges and Sunshine. It stars Emily Watson and Hugo Weaving, about a woman that became an activist for children and reuniting families because children would be taken, kidnapped from their homes and given to other families in Australia. This was a big racket going on, and she found out about it and made it her life's work to reunite the kids with their original birth parents. So those are the two movies. They're in limited release now. So thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Let me find where the hell are these interviews. Okay, there they are. Okay. We'll be back Sunday night, God willing, with episode 5 of the Kubrick series, The Shining, The Shining. Hey, have you guys seen that? Have you guys seen that parody trailer of The Shining that's been up forever?
No, I've never seen
it. It makes it look like a feel-good family movie.
Oh no, that
oh,
yeah, that I've seen. Yeah,
that's
just
been up
brilliant.
For a long time.
Just
yeah,
brilliant.
Is.
Shining. All right. All right, guys. Good night. See you next week.
All right. Good night.
Alrighty.
Thanks, everyone. And
bye.
Happy early birthday, Jamie.
Thank you, buddy.
One last pitch.
I'm proud of you, honey. Is that really so hard to believe?
Charlie! No, no, no!
Lisa was so good, so beautiful. She loved me.
Your book is brilliant.
Sometimes I wonder why. Yes, she did.
Hello? Anyone in there? Hello? Why didn't you answer me?
Because, Charlie, you didn't ask a question. I hate you. Your father loves you very much.
Charlie, open this door!
Because of that book, everyone is going to know.
Your behavior is embarrassing.
For who?
You?
For his family! I did something wrong.
No, Michael, you did everything just right.
Who are you? Mommy's little protector?
I heard you just finished a new book. What's it about?
Just read it, okay?
After all that's happened, you think you two could just...
One of us had to be an adult and raise our son.
Fine job you did at that. Listen to me.
No, all I've ever done is listen to you!
There's going to be some changes around here. Big changes. I'm going to change.
Did you sleep with her? Did she tell you everything you so badly need to hear?
Sorry.
How can you be sorry when you have no idea what you're apologizing for?
It hasn't always been like this, has it?
I can't remember, Michael.
It's not your fault. Not your fault.
When those numbers line up, like 11-11,
it's a reminder. Reminds me to tell my mom that I love her.
Where to start would be where this project started for you. What were those initial inspirations that led you to write this film?
Well, the initial inspiration was in the summer of 1999. over Easter Sunday. My parents were coming home from Easter service, and they were making, I mean, it's crazy. They were making a left turn on a protected light, and a car just ran through the intersection and basically T-boned them. And my mother passed away. And so, you know, it's whatever, it's 12 years later and it still sucks. But that fall of 99, I started film school. And I was up at Columbia University, and my previous life or career was as a teacher. I taught 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, so going to film school was something that was completely foreign and new to me, and I didn't know how a film was made. I thought it was made with 10 cameras all running at the same time, that sort of thing. So it gave me an escape, really, just to completely immerse myself into learning the craft of filmmaking.
Yeah.
But, you know, a huge component of that is also writing. And when it came time to start writing a screenplay, you know, I chose to write about my mom. And I think it was more of, you know, I needed it. I needed that sort of cathartic experience. And that screenplay became Fireflies in the Garden. So that's the genesis of it.
When something that random and I mean, it's not, you can't make sense of an event like that.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that you eventually discovered that you were trying to express in Fireflies in the Garden? Because it might be that you're just trying to put something out there, put your feelings out there. But in the end, what do you think you were trying to get to?
Two things, really. By the way, nobody's asked that question. That's a good one. The first thing is, you know, apart from the fact that my father is really kind, and I want to make sure that that gets stated, my father is not Charlie from Fireflies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the family is a lot like ours. You know, mom, dad, sister, brother, and the number of years that separate me from my sister is the same number of years from Ryan Reynolds to Shannon Lucio's character. But to make the story short, it's like, you know, I was describing it to my father, and it's a table that has four legs. And each of those four legs represents someone in the family, you know, like mom, dad, sister, brother. Mm-hmm. And after all these years, you know, after 20, 30 years of being together, all this stuff accumulates on the table and it hasn't moved, you know, for decades. And then when one of the legs of the table is suddenly just taken away, the table gets still balanced. You just have to reposition everything that's been placed on top of it.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And in that repositioning, it's like something gets released. Like there's all that potential. My dad's a physicist, so he'd like this. All that potential energy is released into something that's kinetic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the main theme of the film. It's like, what does get released? And, you know, the last thing I wanted to do with Fireflies was make something that, you know, it's not a big idea movie, or it's not a concept or a franchise film. It's just something that I wanted to be as honest as possible.
And it is very honest, and I love effective movies about the family and generations of families, and because they all speak kind of universal truths. I mean,
mm-hmm.
But you've assembled the most remarkable cast, where individually, I mean, they're terrific for their roles, but that doesn't guarantee that they'll be terrific together as a family unit. Did they have time to acclimate themselves to one another before the shooting started?
No. the reason why I laugh about that is because, I mean, that would have been my dream, to be able to have them, you know, to have the entire cast together. I don't think we ever had the entire cast together. Because now that I think about it, since the film's told in present and past, The only continuity between the two is Willem,
right,
in terms of the actors. Everyone else, you know, was shifted out. No, we didn't have the time because we were an independent film on a tight schedule. The luxury of rehearsal wasn't anything that we really had. But that being said, I mean, I did have the opportunity to meet with each of the actors and to talk about their characters and to go through backstory and needs and wants. And so, you know, that afforded us, you know, at least just some sort of intimacy when we actually arrived on set.
Right.
I mean, Emily flew from London. It was funny, yeah. She flew in from London. She was stopped in San Antonio. Something about her visa was messed up, and she was actually detained by, you know, whoever it was back then. She was actually detained because her papers weren't right. And then one of the officers recognized her and said, "Oh, my gosh, you're that actress, Emily Watson." And so she had to drive from San Antonio down to Austin where we were filming. And pretty much as when she got out of her car, we threw her on set.
Wow.
And her first scene was the scene right after the car crash. So not only did we throw her on set, we threw her on set in a very dramatic, you know, kind of a gut-wrenching, scene. So she was thrown into the fire right away. Yeah, but that was the pace of the film.
Well, that's what you had to do to get it made. That's how you how you had to do it. Yeah, but I mean, it's a beautiful piece, and they're all terrific in it. You know, I know I have limited time with you, but I want to make sure that I got to ask you about this. This is the final film that Dee Dee Allen worked on.
Yes, it is.
What a remarkable contribution to film. What was that experience like working with her?
Dee Dee Allen is she was remarkable, you know. Like I said, my experience with film before film school was minimal at best. It wasn't what I did, but I knew of Dee Dee Allen's name, you know, because she had edited some of my favorite movies. And so the opportunity, I remember when we were going through editors' lists of hiring a potential editor or a possible editor for Fireflies, and I saw Dee Dee Allen's name, and I said, this can't be right, you know. One, how can we afford Dee Dee? And two, you know, why would she do this? But, you know, what happened is she had actually read the original script and really enjoyed it. So it was something that she wanted to do. And so, yeah, it was weird. It was one of those things, you know, we would be editing all day, and then during our downtime, I would kind of ask her questions about, like, you know, Reds or Bonnie and Clyde or, you know,
wow,
just any of the other films that she made. Because she really, you know, she fostered and developed and nurtured the whole notion of a director's editor, you know, where it was the vision of the story that's paramount. And she's amazing. God bless Dee Dee, you know. And yeah, when I heard that she passed away, it was just, it was heartbreaking.
I was in the children's home in the UK, and I was only 10. This man in a suit, he came to see me, and he says, your mother's dead, you know, so how'd you like to go to Australia? If the sun shines every day, you pick oranges off the trees for your breakfast. Now you're telling me that she might not have been dead after all.
You're talking about the organized deportation of children in care.
I mean organized at the level of government.
Why has no one ever heard about it?
We're processed in here. By the end of that day, I was at the Christian Brothers. The boys put every stone of that building together.
9 years old, lifting rocks the size of my upper body. He had this big, knobby stick, and he would
What happened to some of these children is an outrage. Do you know how many?
We don't have any more information.
I just want to find my mum.
I was contacted by a woman who has lost all contact with her family, and I'm here today to see if any of you are in the same position.
Shut the door.
Listen, you bitch. Stop talking about the brothers.
Have I disturbed you, brother?
From the producers of The King's Speech comes a true story of generations lost.
I'm hearing an awful lot about the distress caused to the brothers. No one's talking about the distress caused to the children who were supposed to be in their care.
And the woman whose courage...
I'm gonna rip you alive!
Get home.
...brought them together.
I can't stop. There's no one else.
Thank you. You found my mother.
Fighting for his marriage on our side.
What was done with the very best intention.
They just want to know who they are.
How did the project come to you?
Well, I saw something in the newspaper in London, and then I read Margaret's book, and then that led me to see her, and I went up to Nottingham to meet her. And I remember sitting on her sort of sofa, listening to her tell me a story about a guy that had just come back from Australia to meet his mum for the first time in 40 years. And that was the start of the film, really. It was that simple. I just thought that was an extraordinary concept, you know, people coming back to find their parents after mm-hmm. such a long time. And so, yeah, that was the kind of that's how it started. And then I was sort of sat opposite Margaret, and of course she's an extraordinary person, quite an inspirational woman. And it was those two things together really that made me want to make the film.
Well, tell me a little, what was that initial meeting of her like?
Funny enough, initially I was quite intimidated, if I'm honest. You know, and slightly apprehensive, but I kind of had a very clear idea of a film in my head, but Margaret, I think initially was quite skeptical, to be honest. I think she was sort of quite unsure about what sort of film it would be, and what it would be like, you know, and maybe how intrusive it would be into her life, and so it was. But we talked for a long time, and then at the end of it, we just decided, let's just meet up again, you know, in a few weeks' time and carry on talking. And that's kind of how it went, really, for the first couple of years. We just sort of stay in touch and kept talking.
Yes, so you say a couple of years. So this was it's kind of interesting that, you know, Margaret is, the work she does, she's very meticulous, it sounds like, in giving trust to someone.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. I think she had to sort of trust me and know she wanted to be confident about what the film was going to be, really. And you know, but also in the course of our research, of course, we met a lot of the real people that she'd helped, and I would meet them and spend a lot of time with them. So there was a lot of trust to build up. I think that's right.
And when you finally started on the project officially, how closely involved did she stay? Mm-hmm.
Well, we showed her the script, every draft of the script, and she gave us notes and thoughts, and I tried to incorporate them. I mean, once we started to, so that was in the kind of scripting process. Mm-hmm. But once we were actually making the film, I think we both kind of had a sort of notion that I had to get on with it, and she had to step back, and that's kind of how it went, really. So once we were in production, she wasn't terribly involved until we'd finished the film and she came to see it.
Tell me a little about Emily Watson. How did she get involved, and what made you say that she's the right one for Margaret?
Yeah, I mean, I'd been a fan of hers for a long time, as we all have, and... we'd got a list, and she was at the top of it. And we you know, the reason I really wanted Emily to play the part is that for me she has sort of a very special combination, which is not that common, which is that she's a very good listener, and she's also a very strong person, you know, quite sorted and quite strong. And also she's got a great sense of mischievous fun, which we really wanted in the part. And then finally, she's got, of course, the heart is that she's got this extraordinary frailty and sort of vulnerability, you know, which I think the frailty is sort of almost a contradiction of the strengths in a way. But if it is, it was a sort of contradiction at the heart of the character. So that was kind of why I wanted Emily, really, and I really, really wanted her. And we'd worked on the script for a couple of years, and I sort of was biding my time when to send it to her, and eventually I sent it over to her, and she loved it. And then we met up on a very snowy day in London. It was freezing cold, and the whole city had ground to a halt because we got so much snow. So we met up and drank a lot of hot chocolate, and I showed her a photograph, actually. Photograph of some of the kids. And once she saw the photograph and we'd spoken, she really wanted to do the film.
And did she do that thing that, you know, when there's a live counterpart, did she meet Margaret? Did she do that?
No, she didn't meet Margaret before we made the film. No. No.
Was that a choice that you two made, or is that a choice on her part?
Yeah, it was a choice that we made together, really, because I think that Emily felt very strongly she didn't want to get involved in a sort of, didn't want to get bogged down in a sort of narrow impersonation, because of course no one knows the real Margaret, so there's no there's no benefit from impersonating someone who isn't famous, obviously. And there was that, and also I really had a strong sense that she needed to be free to create her own character on screen, you know, and have the room to do that and to make her own sort of choices. That was something we decided together, and then they met after a screening, you know, a few months ago, and of course they got on really, really well. I mean, Emily did a lot of research and watched quite a lot of Margaret on tape, so she had some clue.
And what was that like when you finally showed the film to Margaret?
It was terrifying. we just had it in the screening room in London, in Soho. And Margaret came down and watched it with her family. And I sort of paced around Soho as the film was going through. And then I went back, and I think I walked into the screening room, and I think I said, are we still talking? And she sort of smiled and gave me a big hug, and I knew it was going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the other major performer I wanted to ask you about is Hugo Weaving.
Mm.
And, you know, I've been a Hugo Weaving fan for, you know, obviously he's known for mass audiences because of Lord of the Rings and The Matrix, but I've been a fan going all the way back to the Jocelyn Moorhouse film Proof, where you know, it still remains his greatest performance. And here so this character is obviously something, you know, for mass audiences. If they see this film, this is they're going to see a different side of him, not the usual villainous side. And so I was wondering what was getting him involved, you know.
Well, he was extraordinary to work with, too. I mean, you know, he actually met the person who on whom that character was kind of partly based, and they spent quite a lot of time together. And I know that he was quite marked by that. You know, he made a big impact on him that afternoon. And, you know, I'd obviously, like you, I'd seen all his films, and I loved the way he can inhabit that kind of broken soul, you know, that there's something so fundamentally broken within that man that can only be fixed by him knowing his family.
Right.
And Hugo sort of in an extraordinary way. I mean, when we were shooting, I remember kind of often hairs would, you know, would stand up on the back of my neck because he sort of inhabited it in such an extraordinary way. And so I often felt quite privileged, you know, to be stood by the camera. And all of us, when we were making the film, we could see that he was doing something quite special.
Mm-hmm. And this story, you know, in other hands, or, you know, let's say if it was a more international with an American kind of backing, this kind of story could easily have been kind of pumped up for the sensational aspects of it and even the melodramatic aspects of it. So I'm curious, what did it take on your part to not fall into that and not wanting to do that? Because even as a filmmaker, you know, it might be tempting, but it's not maybe the best way to serve a story.
Yeah. Well, I desperately didn't want to make it melodramatic because we were really interested in the people, in the characters, and in their central dilemma of wanting to know, kind of, as they would put it, who they are, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that with melodrama, can you? Because all it will do is sort of cloud, when you're trying to explore a character, melodrama will only cloud it and there will be more, you know, more noise, but not much light. And so that was, and a lot of these things are taste, aren't they? I think you can't separate your own taste out from the film you make, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that, I guess, really. But it was the characters mainly. We really wanted to understand them better by the end of the film.
Your father is very well known for his films that are very passionate and socially conscious films. So I'm kind of curious I guess, you know, the obvious thing is, I guess, if any of the influence that had on you.
Gosh, well, I'm sure a lot rubbed off, obviously, because all parents, you know, are very important in the lives of their children, aren't they? Of course they are. So I think a lot probably did rub off. I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, gosh, lots, of course.
Did he ever, has he seen the film?
Yeah, he's seen it a couple of times, yeah, yeah.
And, did he ever fall into that fatherly temptation of even, I guess, being critical, or did he feel full approval?
No, not at all. I mean, I asked him to come into the cutting room, and he gave me some suggestions, and, you know, some of them we did, and some of them we didn't do. But, you know, you've got to ignore some of your parents' advice, haven't you?